Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohn.
I'm Kevin Beckham.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackey.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spring from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yeah.
Yes, welcome back to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. As usual, we've got one guest lined up for you and we've got two exciting topics under discussion. We hope you'll stay with us for the whole podcast, and we thank all of those of you that have been downloading it because the numbers are going through the roof and it's always good to get your support and your feedback. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, I'm going to believe I'm starting us off this week, but before I do, just to let people know who our guest is, we're going to be catching up with David Sweetman, who is the CEO of Scottish Hockey. Now, one of the reasons we're catching up with him is you may remember we had fee-free football the other week from Balga Soccer Club.
Yeah.
Well, David Sweetman, when he went into the role with Scottish Hockey, one of his tasks was to grow the numbers of young people playing hockey. And what he did was bring the registration fee down to £1 for every player, and the numbers have grown unbelievably in the last 3 years. So we're going to hear from him and talk about that, and also how Scottish hockey is really on the rise at the moment. The clubs have increased, the teams are doing well, they've got more players now in the Great Britain squads, and it's a really positive story.
Also, they're going to have a bit of a boost in the next year or so with the Pro Hockey League. With Pakistan being based there, so that'll be interesting.
We discussed that as well in the interview, so you'll hear how that came
Excellent.
About and all the thoughts behind that and how it's going to be marketed as well.
I'll look forward to that.
Anyway, first of all is my topic. I'm going to say congratulations to the Socceroos. You left us all with hearts in our mouths for a very, very long time, but you got there in the end, and congratulations to all the players, all the coaching staff and everybody for achieving that. I would also like to say congratulations to one media outlet for actually revealing that Qantas did not donate the charter flight from Honduras back to Australia, and that the FFA paid $250,000 for the lease of that aircraft, which is the going rate. So there you go. So that was good that one outlet actually did report the facts on that one. But what the game said to me, and that's just taking away the emotion of wanting Australia to qualify. Obviously, I want Australia, like most people, to qualify for every World Cup. But my question this time is, do they deserve to be there? And what I mean is that is when you see teams like Italy aren't there, the Netherlands aren't there, Irish aren't there, there's a lot of top football nations aren't there. Now, if the Socceroos had to play any of those three nations, would they get a victory over them? I don't believe this team would. So that comes back to my argument, which, you know, I've said this for a long, long time. I don't think the confederation model is what football fans around the world want anymore. In that it's great, yes, we get four teams from Asia, we get five teams from Africa, we've got, you know, teams from all the confederations. And so it is a global event in terms of that. But to me, it should be done on merit. It should be the best teams playing in those finals. And what I would like to see is I would like to see us do away with the confederations, but what you would do is actually still have a draw, but of all the 206 FIFA nations, go into a pot, and yes, you seed Asia, you seed Africa, so that in each pool, there are teams from Africa, there are teams from South America, there are teams from Europe, there are teams from Asia, so that suddenly you are all playing against each other, home and away, and let's be honest, now, for most countries, the money that there is in football, the travel would not be an issue. Because if you look again, Australia fly players back from Europe to playing games in Australia. So do some of the Asian countries. They have to do the same thing. The Africans all have to do that because their top players are predominantly in Europe. The South Americans have to do the same. So it wouldn't be that hard because if they're playing a game in Europe, obviously those players can join the team in Europe. They don't have to fly back only for their home games when they're playing in those countries. But I would like to see the World Cup now being about the best teams in the world. So it really is a showcase rather than being the best four teams from every region in the world. Because if you look at the last World Cup, all four teams from Asia came bottom of their pool. None of them won a game. Now, this World Cup's going to be really interesting to see whether they improve on that. Because I think if they don't, then the call for a change is going to come from the European nations and the stronger footballing nations like South America. The other thing I feel very strongly about is that the game Honduras against Australia, if you look at the fact that they want to expand the World Cup to 48 teams, those two teams would have definitely qualified. And again, if you're a true football fan and you love the game, and you're listening to this, just sit there for a moment and say, would you want to watch those two teams playing in a World Cup again because they got there because there's 48 teams? Or do you want to see the best nations play? And I know personally, as much as I want to see the Socceroos do well, I want to see the best teams playing the best football against the best teams. And for me, the expansion should be put on hold on the basis of games such as that. And I think it needs revisiting. And if FIFA is going to move forward, they've got to start addressing issues like this.
Yeah, there's a few issues there, actually. There's a few there. I'll start by saying I must have been the only person in Australia that was hoping they didn't qualify, that Honduras won, because I was going to ring up every talkback station in this country and invite all of those soccer followers who are desperately sad over their team's demise that they can come to our sport, hockey, and watch successful teams at a World Cup play. Teams that have won World Cups and Olympic gold medals in full open tournaments, not under 21 tournaments, that sort of thing. And I've missed my opportunity now because the Socceroos won. So half of me's really happy, but half of me's a bit sad.
Can I just say one thing on that? The one concern that I do have with Australia qualifying, and this would be possibly the only reason that I would have wanted them not to qualify, but is the fact that I think that the certain people in the ivory towers of the FFA are going to think, oh, haven't we done well? And they're not going to actually, and I call for this on our website, notthefootyshow.com, that we need to have a full review of the development of players in this country, because the talent on display on the pitch in that game against Honduras was well below the standard from 10 years ago. And that is because the development got totally restructured when the new FFA was born. They threw out the old, which they didn't need to. If they'd have just tinkered with it, they brought in the Dutch coaches. And how ironic, isn't it? We had Dutch coaches, a Dutch system brought in. Where are the Dutch? Didn't qualify for the Euros, didn't qualify for the World Cup. So why did we go with them? Was that an informed decision? I don't think so. I think it was an emotional decision based on the success of Gus Hiddink. Oh, we must go the Dutch way because Gus was successful. And again, this is why I think these things need to be reviewed now, because if they're not in the next few years, Australia will not qualify in 4 years' time. Well, they might if it's expanded to 48 teams. But if it was 32, I don't think they would qualify, and then it may be a long time before they qualify again.
I must admit, I saw nothing in that game that made me think either of those two teams, Honduras or Australia, were going to be doing anything more in Russia than going for a three-week holiday. Nothing said to me about the way they played or the players on the pitch or the style of play that, well, this is worthwhile watching. These guys might be in with a chance to do well in Russia. I just saw nothing from either of them.
If you look in the campaign as well, John, and this is another thing that scares me, is the top goal scorers for Australia throughout their World Cup campaign were Tim Cahill and Mile Jedinek. You know, and they were quite a few goals ahead of the next highest, which was Tommy Juric with 5 goals. So, you know, you're relying...
And Jedinek's scoring a lot of penalties too.
Oh, he is, yeah. And if we look again at that game against Honduras, a deflected free kick, which... A lot of people who know football have said, you know what, if that hadn't gone in, I reckon it could well have gone to penalties. But, of course, once that goal went in, Honduras had to push for an equaliser so that then they would go through, and they conceded 2 rather weak penalties by their defensive standards.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the game was all over. But touching on that, and as you said, you know, how this team is going to go in Russia, that's why I think Ange Postecoglou knew that. I mean, if we look, he took over at the last minute 4 years ago when the World Cup was in Brazil. After Holger Osic had lost 6-0 to Brazil, 6-0 to France, then there was a call that this was unacceptable, even though Holger Osic had said, we're a long way behind the top nations. And he was right. But anyway, Ange Postecoglou came in, he said, I've got this vision, how we're going to play, we don't need to fear anyone. And I will be fair to him, but the team at that World Cup played without fear. They took on the Netherlands, played superbly, but they still conceded 3 goals in all 3 games they played. Yeah. They still lost every single game they played, and they still were on the plane home. Now, the question is, did Ange Postecoglou know that this team was never going to be able to play with the same flair as the team he took 4 years ago? I think, yes, he did. Did he know that they're probably going to struggle, and it's not going to reflect well on him as a coach compared to 4 years ago? I think, yes, he did. And I think he thought, you know what, my coaching stock's pretty high in that I've got a very average group of players to qualify for a World Cup. I won the Asia Cup. I played with Flair at the last World Cup. So at the moment, everything looks pretty good. So in the shop window, I'm now available. If I go to the World Cup and we get pumped and we play badly, my stock's going to lower. And I think he's made a very wise decision from a career perspective. A lot of people very emotional, feel he's betrayed the team. But at the end of the day, this is his job. He is a coach by profession, and he is only, I think he's a year younger than me, he's 52 years of age. So he wants to stay in the game at least for another 10 years. So he has to look after number one.
What I find interesting too is, and I'm, if I was a power broker within Australian soccer, I would be very worried about the fact that the number one player in our team is a 37-year-old. And he's a remarkable player. Tim Cahill is remarkable. His resilience and everything. Don't get me wrong. It's not a sledge of Tim Cahill in any way, shape or form. But when a 37, 38-year-old is your key attacker and the key to you winning games, you have a serious problem. He should be the icing on the, on top of the cake. He should be the little cherry that you put on top. Comes on with 20 minutes to go when you need a goal, that sort of stuff. He shouldn't be starting games as your number one key striker. It's just, it puts the rest of Australian soccer in the light that it should be seen in when he's taking on those roles.
But the other thing that gets me is, and it is, let's be honest, when the FFA helped bring Tim Cahill back to the to play for Melbourne City, they invested money in him. Now, part of the deal with that is that they have to promote Tim Cahill. Tim Cahill is the face of football. So now we get perpetuated on us the greatest ever Socceroo. Seriously? He is the greatest goal scorer, without a shadow of a doubt. As you said, he's a remarkable player, and he is one of the best Socceroos ever to come out.
Yeah.
Now, what we have to put into context is he was previously a midfielder who's been now pushed into an attacking role. But seriously, was he the best? I mean, I think Mark Viduka, if you look at his career internationally, you look at Lucas Neal, you look at Harry Kuehl, there are players, Mark Schwarzer again, there are players even from the generations before that who were trailblazers, who again,
Craig Johnston.
Standard, yeah, exactly, you know.
Didn't play for the Socceroos.
But I'm sorry, Tim Cahill in my book, he would always be up there as one of the top players, probably in the top 10. As for the greatest Socceroo, that's a debate that you can have in any bar around the country, but he would certainly not be my best ever Socceroo, the greatest ever Socceroo.
I think we should also bear in mind that he's playing because no one's putting pressure on him. There's not a younger player that is making his position untenable. He's there because none of you guys are good enough. Will he go to Russia?
Well, it'll be interesting who the new coach is and whether they decide to take him or not. Because, and the other thing that could come into that is whether the FFA actually put pressure on the new coach to take him because they've invested this money in him and because Tim Cahill is the face of the Socceroos.
Well, you've got an interesting situation where the top two goal scorers are at the back end of their careers. And I don't know, Jednak, he's had a few injuries recently.
He's not been playing first team football at the moment. So,
that's right.
Again, if he picks up another injury.
And so there's no guarantee he's going. There's no guarantee Cahill's going. They're looking a bit thin in the cupboard. And I don't think they've got a very good defence, to be honest. I don't think they defend very well at all.
Matt Ryan has done really well in goal for them. And I think Trent Sainsbury has been very good. He's made the odd mistake, but he's still a young player. I think he's really shown that he's good. German when he came in, or Yerman as he's now called. He was called German when he was in the A-League, but he's now Yerman. But anyway, he, I thought as well, played a couple of good games in those games against Syria and against Bangladesh. But I know there's a lot of Australian fans don't like him. But to me, Mark Milligan has been Mr. Consistency for them. Okay, he made a bad pass in the Syria game that led to a goal. But if you look over the whole qualifying campaign, the man who was consistent throughout, he's not flash, he keeps it simple, was Mark Milligan.
Yeah. I just see that when the pressure comes on, they panic a bit.
Yeah, I think they're like rabbits in their headlights.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, but they can get better. They've got to play together, though, and that's the hard thing. You got to get your defence right, you've got to play together. You've got to have that understanding. any idiot can run on a lead and collect a ball that's been kicked 30 metres up the field to them, but to defend, you've got to really have team structures and you've got to have understanding with your teammates and those sorts of things.
I've heard some of the pundits say that this is a group of players that are on the brink of greatness. That was the word used by one particular commentator. I'm sorry. I've seen nothing to actually back up that statement. And just on that subject, as we wrap up this little rant on the football side of things, I just want to say to some of the TV radio stations here, if you're going to ring somebody for an opinion, which was happened with Ange Postecoglou's resignation, now please get people who are not just going to be a public relations voice box for the FFA and the A-League. Get somebody who actually is going to say what they think or actually has an opinion, because I heard a certain person come on one of the radio stations here and it was just, honestly, John, it was propaganda. It was like living in a communist state, because the stuff coming out of this person's mouth was just nothing else but propaganda, saying how brilliant the Socceroos were, how great the FFA was, and what a how the A-League is one of the top leagues in the world. Give me a break.
You're bringing back very fond memories of the great man George Grealicic when you talk about that. He always had the idea that sports organisations were communist. And that's... Thanks, George.
Well, yeah, I've worked with George, as you know, at 6PR, and him and I agreed on a great many issues.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Ah, the great man.
Now, there is a great footballer. Well, as we mentioned at the top of the podcast, we have one guest on the show, as we always do, and this time we're turning our attention to Scottish hockey. Now, we mentioned Balga Soccer Club had their fee-free football where they were trying to increase their junior members and get them involved in the game. Well, it was a few years ago, David Sweetman took over the role as CEO of Scottish Hockey, and one of the things he had to do was increase the number of players playing, and he also wanted to increase the number of clubs. Now, I've been trying to pin him down for a number of years to actually have this interview, and I'm glad to say we finally managed to get a time where we were both available to talk. So we're now going to hear from the CEO of Scottish Hockey, David Sweetman. David Sweetman, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, we've been trying to catch up for a number of years now, and we just seem to have kept missing each other. But one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is when you came into the role of CEO of Scottish Hockey, one of the things you wanted to do was increase the numbers of children playing the game, which obviously would then transfer into the number of adults playing the game. How did you go about that?
I think we've been really fortunate, first and foremost, with some support we've had from Sports Scotland in terms of us being able to deliver a regional development team. So we're able to have a regional development manager in basically every area in Scotland. And they're tasked quite simply with making our clubs as strong as they can be and offering bespoke support. And I think that's been a real benefit for us. Additionally to that, we changed the way our membership was calculated or paid for, and we offered for kids that were just coming into the sport for the very first time, we offered it membership for £1, so insurance opportunity to play in a number of our competitions, because we just wanted to get them in the door, understand who they are, and be able then to track their journey hopefully into senior hockey and then hopefully Scotland.
It's one thing offering it for £1, but how do you cover the costs for the clubs or the administrative costs of having those extra numbers? I mean, was there sponsorship that sort of made up the shortfall that we're always told administrators need?
I think there's a number of things. Firstly, it was that important to us that it was worth taking a small loss on, because we just wanted to get them in and fully understand who our members were. And we know that price can be a barrier. And I think as well, there has been some good support around, things like our club accreditation program, that have allowed our clubs to become stronger in that regard.
I noticed when you said about you've got these now regional development offices or whatever, I'm presuming that they are also doubling up as a scout to basically identify talent as well that can then be, you know, fast tracked or given, you know, the chance to excel at the highest level?
We would actually do it in a different way. Our regional team are very focused on supporting the clubs. If we were looking for talented players, we've made a number of changes to our performance pathway and are just in the early stages. So our Academy program had its first induction yesterday. And that is a great opportunity to get the best 40, 50 players in Scotland and really give them some support, strength and conditioning, psychology of a positive sports kind, and hopefully get them up to a level. Because we're quite a small country, we're fairly confident in being able to spot the right talent, and we have a good inter-district competition that allows our age group coaches to spot talented players early, and we've started inter-districts at a slightly younger age, more as an enjoyable opportunity rather than a competitive one at under 14. But it still gives us the opportunity to identify talented players at a fairly young age.
Now, I notice your mission statement says that Scottish hockey is there to provide opportunities for more players to enjoy hockey. It's one thing saying that, but I mean, you've obviously, with the £1 membership, managed to pull more people in to play the game. Are you noticing that the game is actually growing and that people are actually enjoying it and converting to it?
I think our membership figures probably speak for themselves. So we've had 50% growth in 3 years, of which a lot is that new youth competitions membership. But we're seeing growth in adults as well. And I think a big growth area for us and a focus area going forward will be Masters hockey. When you look at Scottish hockey from an international perspective, we technically field 22 international teams from under 16 all the way through to over 70. And I think we're proud of being a sport for life. And I think that's coming through, that we're retaining members better. And certainly we're filling up, I suppose, the bottom of the pyramid with more younger members. The challenge is always how you retain them within a system for life.
Well, one of the things I'm sure that helps you retain is the success of the national teams, and obviously the men's team making the Hockey World League semi-finals, and also their performances at the Euros must have done wonders for hockey up there, because suddenly everybody believes the team can achieve and compete on the world stage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you just need to look at the prestigious Scottish Sports Awards that happen in early December, and where the men are up for Team of the Year against Celtic, the football team who had an unbeaten domestic treble, and against the Scottish Rugby Sevens team who won one of their elite rounds for the first time. So to be in that calibre of competition in that regard is shows you where they've got to, but it's just a fantastic achievement for the men. We were really determined that with the Glasgow National Hockey Centre, we wanted to host events, and we worked really hard to get the opportunity to host a home European B division. And absolutely thrilled to see the guys go out there, perform, and for the first time in 15 years, return to where we think they belong, which is A division. And I think we're really looking forward to putting the program and prep together for Antwerp in 2019.
You didn't mention as well that Derek Forsyth is also up for Coach of the Year in those sports awards as well.
Yes, I think I'm showing the modesty Derek normally shows. Derek's done a fantastic job with the team. A lot of the guys have come with him on the journey from under 21, when Derek was head coach of under 21, into the full squad. So again, yeah, I mean, he's up against two really talented coaches for the Coach of the Year award. But again, it's fantastic recognition for his, I think, his hard work and his commitment to manage. And also the fact that he was assistant coach with GB when they won Sultan Cup in Malaysia. So again, really good year for Derek, and I know he'll be focused on commie games next year, and then is focused now on Europeans in 2019.
The other thing that must be really satisfying for you and the whole team and all the players is, I mean, you've got, I think it was recently, 6 women were selected into the elite women's development squad for Great Britain. You had 2 young players in the Sultan of Johor Cup tournament as well, that the Great Britain did really well at there. So there is also the players are coming through. That second phase of players looks like you're going to have depth for a while.
Yeah, I think we've worked over the last year and a half to 2 years. We've, and especially with Andy Tanner coming as our new head of performance, worked really hard on the relationship with Great Britain to really understand what they're looking for in terms of players, really encourage engagement at all levels. I mean, we've gone as far as the Futures Cup, which was previously an English interdivisional event, now has Scotland and Wales both playing that, albeit under assumed names, as the Caledonian Cougars and the Celtic Panthers. I think the girls have really showed what they're capable of in terms of the elite development. So to have six in there is great, and all of those are full internationals. So it shows you the kind of the caliber and the pathway there. For the men, again, two in the under 21s is fantastic. We're waiting to see. The men's elite development program squads haven't been finalised, so we'll see if those guys and if any others have been successful in that. We've had some additional players in for the wider GB selection, so great to have athletes knocking on those doors, because we want to get them in the right place for Tokyo in 2020 and Paris in 2024.
One of the things that I find really interesting is obviously Scottish hockey is developing. And it's sort of small steps, as you've said. You're building slowly. You've got goals down the track. Now, the Pro League was probably a little bit beyond you at the moment. But the interesting thing is that Pakistan are going to be playing their games in Scotland. How did that come about? And do you see that as a massive benefit, obviously, to hockey as a whole in Scotland?
I suppose that we were very aware of the Pro League. Pakistan were unable to host and had asked for... I think some advice from other countries about who might be interested. So we had a conversation with Pakistan. We showed them what we can do in terms of event hosting. We have a strong Scottish Pakistani community in Glasgow. So I think there's 35,000 Scottish Pakistanis within 20 minutes of the stadium. So combine that with a nation that loves its sport, hockey going places, and a local authority that's built the facility and supportive of our events. It was obviously a very attractive package for the FIH. For us, it's a phenomenal opportunity. If it was just us hosting some matches for Pakistan, we'd be less interested. But I think 8 matches a year for 4 years, best teams in the world coming to Scotland, a community that we can really work with, a great chance to raise profile. I don't think there's a higher level of international sport that will be available in Scotland in 2019. So, I mean, combine all that with some development opportunities and a commitment from Pakistan to play some matches against our men, mean that it's a package from grassroots to elite that I think has the absolute opportunity to change the sport positively in Scotland.
Well, it wouldn't just be Pakistan, because all of the teams in the Pro League, they're not allowed to play each other between games. So I'm thinking once they arrive in Scotland, you can offer the services of your national team to play against the other teams that are participating as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've already seen that benefit with Spain as an example in terms of building that relationship. A lot will depend on the team's individual plans. I mean, I think some will come play in Scotland and then potentially play in London a couple of days later. So it's all around their individual movements. But yes, absolutely, the opportunity to get teams here in Scotland unable to play apart from that one-off showpiece match gives us a great opportunity, both in terms of being in Scotland and also our proximity to London for teams that are playing in Lee Valley.
One of the questions I have to ask is, obviously, Pakistan are playing their games there. The FIH have approved it. The Pro League is the FIH's competition. Pakistan's the team competing in the Pro League. So who's going to actually market Pakistan playing there? Will that fall to the FIH and Pakistan, or will Scottish hockey also promote the games as well to ensure that they get those good crowds?
I think you'll see us being fairly, very strong in the marketing. We recognise the benefits that it brings, so it will definitely be for the conversations we've had with Pakistan. It will be a joint effort, but we will be very strong in that regard.
sitting on the other side of the world and looking at how Scottish hockey has developed since you and I had the first conversation when you were umpiring a tournament, it really looks as if there must be a really positive vibe about the place, in that everything seems to be going really well at the moment. I'm sure underneath, like everything, there are problems, but do you really feel that you are moving in the right direction and that everybody's pulling in the same direction?
I think when we set down our strategic goals 3 years ago, if you do a comparison against where we are now, the vast majority, we're in the right direction. Membership has grown considerably. Men, as we mentioned, performing better. We're seeing some great opportunities for the women. Commercially, we're doing better than we did before. We need to keep doing better. Long-term government funding is always going to be a challenge for us going forward. But generally, positively, really happy with where we're going and a general direction. And we'll always get those problems that you mentioned, those challenges. But that's life as being a national organisation. But no, absolutely thrilled at where we're getting to.
Do you have sort of ambitions down the track in that you in so many years might make a World League final, or you might make the World Cup, or etc. like that? Are those the goals now being set?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with the World Cup becoming a 16-team competition, we absolutely, World Cup qualification is on our focus. Our women were really close. I mean, a draw against China, so ninth ranked in the world, came down to a critical game in the World League semi-finals that they lost 2-1, having gone 2-0 down fairly early. But it's a young squad and something I think they'll learn and build on. But World Cups are absolutely in our wheelhouse in terms of where we want to get the men and women to. I think they're achievable. To have both teams in World League semi-final was a great set. The men's experience, particularly with Elite, going into A division, will give them a good opportunity to really build on that going forward. But yes, World Cups, definitely. In terms of World League, obviously that all changes with the introduction of the Pro League. So we'll evaluate that when I think those details are announced. But definitely World Cup will be very front and centre of where we want to get to.
Well, David, congratulations to you and the team. I think it's fantastic what you've achieved. It's a really good story. It's great to see Scottish hockey moving forward. And thanks very much for your time today.
That's no problem at all. Thank you very much for having me, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Chris Sorello from the Kookaburras, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to the podcast of Not the Footy Show. We should say congratulations to Chris Sorello, who announced his retirement just shy of the 200 caps, which is, I'm sure, a big disappointment, but what a career.
Oh, fantastic career, and one of the premier drag flickers in the game. And the thing that was most impressive about Sorello's drag flicking for mine is he always went low. His goals were scored low on the right, your right-hand post if you're a defender. Goalies just struggle to get them, and he was great. And he's one of the poster boys in our reverse stick efforts to get the drag flick. The rules changed on penalty corners for the safety issues.
Yeah, to keep it low.
To keep it low, like a free hit, like
yep,
a hit
that's
should
what
be.
Simon Orchard's been pushing for as well.
It should be that way, but Sorello is the poster boy for us because all of his goals are scored low. And well done, Chris Sorello. And well done also on Chris sponsoring your coverage as well of the Sultan of Johor Cup as well. He's a good hockey man.
Well,
his family.
Yeah, and he wants to put back into the game. And, I mean, there can't be many players who've scored a hat-trick of goals in three finals in 1 year, which, of course, he did 2014. He did the Sultan Aslan Shire Cup final. He did the Commonwealth Games and the World Cup.
And the ones he put past in... Stotman in the World Cup, they were class goals. He's probably as good a goalkeeper as ever has been in the game of hockey, and Sorello just went bang, 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 thanks very much for coming. Mind you, they were former teammates in the Indian Hockey League. I think you might have picked up a few tips along the way.
Absolutely. Now, just quickly again, we had David Sweetman, the CEO of Scottish Hockey, and I think it's fantastic what they've achieved, how they've grown the numbers by more than 50% with that incentive. And as he said, he was prepared to take a bit of a hit on junior fees, but in the interest of the game as a whole. Now, they've had sponsors coming. That's the way it should be. If you don't have the juniors, you will never have anything at the top.
I'm going to mention it again, Ashley. Dairy farming.
You love your dairy.
Oh, I love my dairy farming. The more milk you get, the more milk you have, the more cream you get. And it's all about making sure you got lots and lots of milk. And that's what this is doing.
Well, as we touched on in that interview, if you look at it, they've now got 6 women from Scotland in the Great Britain elite development squad. They had 2 players in the Sultan of Johor Cup team, you know, the England under-21s team that played there. You've got Derek Forsyth now is part of the coaching team for Great Britain as well, which is a huge accolade to him as a Scottish coach. And you've got his son, Alan Forsyth, and Chris Grassick currently in the GB squad. Of course, that will be revisited come the new year. So they're really going in the right direction. And to be nominated for Team of the Year up against Glasgow Celtic in the Scottish Rugby Sevens team, it would be wonderful if they could win that. But I think, as he said in that interview, it's unlikely. And then Derek Forsyth up for Coach of the Year as well in the Scottish Sports Awards. So a fantastic story all round. And let's just hope they can keep going.
And I think you're going to find there's going to be some fun times in Scotland once the Pro Hockey League kicks off, because there's a big Pakistani population in Scotland, and I know from speaking to the Pakistani hockey people that they're really excited about going over there and just enjoying themselves and getting involved with the community there as well.
Well, I think as well that's where David and his team have been quite smart, in that they've realised that this can benefit Scottish hockey. Okay, Scottish hockey's not ready to be in the Pro League, but by having a team playing in it in their country, that's going to attract people to the game, and it may attract again some of the Pakistanis who are just playing on the park, not part of the structure of Scottish hockey, to get more involved with it. And if that's the case, then fantastic.
I would like to have a camera as the players step off the plane, though, in Glasgow or something like that. It's going to be a little bit of a culture shock for them at first, but I'm sure they'll adapt.
Anyway, what's your topic?
Oh, well, on the reverse stick race, we've been talking about video referrals, and hockey at the moment has entered the world of the video referral and still has some teething problems with the system. Well, what struck me about video referrals is at the recent World Hockey League finals in Auckland, you had a situation where the video picked up offences that occurred in the lead up to goals, but no one referred them. No one probably noticed them at the time on the ground, and yet we have this method now where we can see that they weren't legitimate goals. And I'm just struggling with video referrals in any sport at the moment over this idea that video referrals were brought in based on pressure that was perceived to be coming on umpires from television broadcasting. No sports organisation would have brought in video referral if they didn't have to, because it's an extra cost, and they would have been, like soccer is, quite happy to have left it in the hands of the umpires.
I would say you're slightly right. Slightly, because some sports actually wanted it to get the decisions right, because there were financial rewards depending on where you finished in a competition.
Yeah.
So what teams were saying were, if that wrong decision's cost us, we're going to get relegated, as an example.
Well,
and therefore, if we'd have actually been given that goal, we wouldn't have got relegated, and it's cost us X amount of money.
What we're seeing now is that mistakes are happening, and you can see them on video, but they're not being acted upon, because the criteria that are used for a video referral restrict teams from the number of times they can use the referral system. Well, the whole point of video referral is to get rid of howler umpiring decisions, to make sure the correct call comes. So the correct call is the ultimate end game for a video referral system. It shouldn't rely on players' ability to see what's happening on the field necessarily.
You take hockey as that's the one you're talking about. There was another one in the Hockey World League in Auckland.
Yeah.
I forget which game it was, where the team appealed for a foot, I think it was. The umpire went upstairs, and they said, okay, it is a penalty corner, but they lose their referral because it was a back stick, not a foot.
Exactly.
And you go, hang on a sec, that's... And this is where I think that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
That is completely stupid. So, as I've been saying to the FIH for a long time, as a commentator, what I would like them to say is just literally the players, because of the language issues as well, just go up and say, I want to refer that should be a penalty corner, not a 16. And they shouldn't have to say what they're looking for. Just say, or they just say, look, there was an offence there, and they should just replay it and go back to it. And again, the umpire should say goal or no goal. Simple as that. If there's an offence, like they do in rugby, they go, is it a try or no try? Is there any reason why I should not award the try? How difficult would it be for the umpire in hockey to say, is there any reason why I should change my decision on a short corner?
We famously, in hockey, had a situation where the Australian player appealed to the umpire for a referral, and the umpire said, oh, what do you want me to refer? And the player turned to the umpire and said, well, there's three of them. Take your pick.
Yep, Simon Orchard JP Punjab Warriors game. I was commentating that game.
Well, I mean, and that's the classic case of where we have to make, where the system's out of kilter. The player knows an offence has occurred, but what, you know, depending on how he puts it to the umpire, will determine whether or not he gets an advantage or whether it gets turned over. It comes down to semantics, not whether the actual offence occurred, if you understand what I'm trying to get at.
No, I'm not putting it very well.
You
know, we had some diabolical decisions in the International Festival of Hockey where the Japanese should have had a penalty stroke in their game against the Netherlands, which would have put them 1-0 up. Now, okay, they were probably not going to win it, but how different the game would have been if Japan went 1-0 up against the world number one. And Anthony Farry was absolutely livid, and there was another decision in there where, again, they lost their referral, and it was just, it was a penalty corner was given for deliberately playing it over the baseline. Now, if you saw this tackle, there was nowhere else. She tried to just, she literally just blocked the ball in, and it went over the baseline. And, of course, the Dutch scored from the penalty corner. Credit to the Japanese in that they didn't argue, they just accepted it, but there were some really bad decisions. And again, I think some of it, that was actually on the pitch, but I would like to see full-time video umpires, not guys who are sometimes on the pitch, sometimes up in the box, because I think it is a full-time job. You know, need to know what you're looking for, and you need to have that experience. And I think it is a specialised job within hockey in that example.
We were speaking to Keely Dunn, who's a former international umpire.
I listened to that one.
Yeah, and we spoke to her yesterday because she interviewed us. Well, I don't know why she wanted our opinion, but anyway. And she was saying that the first time you go into that video booth, it's quite intimidating. There's a lot of technology there.
Absolutely.
And it's a very intimidating, because when you are called on to do something, all eyes are on you. And what's going on here? And let's face it, that hockey isn't working with the same sort of technology that the bunker for the NRL works with, or the MLB in New York has their bunker set up with, you know, 10 or 12 blokes sitting around with huge screens everywhere. It's not exactly the same setup as those people.
You'll be surprised. For example, for BT Sport, they have inside the truck, they have about 8 screens that they can look at. Now, some of the problem is the communication between the director and the umpire. So the umpire may say, I want to see this again. The director may be struggling to know exactly what shot they want. So there's a few issues like that with communication between the umpire and the director, understanding the sport and understanding actually what angle they want and why, what they're actually looking for. So that is often one of the big things. But there is the technology there. But the other problem, which I'm amazed you haven't raised, that comes up in hockey, is the pressure on the video umpire to make a decision in a certain time frame. So they are being judged by the overarching umpires, whoever, you know, the umpire committee or whatever, and they judge them and they go, well, how long is it taking for them to make a decision? Now, I think on average, and I may be slightly wrong with this, but let's say in London at the Hockey World League semi-finals, the men were making decisions in 24 seconds. No, it was Champions Trophy this was, because the women were playing as well. The women were making them far quicker. But the question we asked afterwards was, okay, they're making them quicker, but who was getting them right most of the time?
And are you gonna...
I'm not going to divulge. No, look, because it's not about that. But,
no, you're right.
I think the key thing is the pressure that's being brought on the umpire to make a decision quickly. But to me, it should be making the right decision,
not on
making a quick decision.
Definitely. And that, we see it in cricket with this, you know, you've got two reviews, that system where the whole idea of video replays and using this technology is to get the right decision. And yet, if you've used up one of your reviews, a guy can be obviously howlingly out, but because you haven't got a review left, the umpire's made a mistake, you're stuffed. And it's interesting that the technology's there, we can use it, we can all see it, we all know it's a mistake and the guy is out, but under the technicality of the system, you're duped.
But this, you see, cricket to me, I find it infuriating with cricket because it just takes too long. And it's bloody obvious half the time when you see it, and you're going, well, we know. And I've complained to the TV stations that I work for who cover cricket, and they go, it'll never change, because that is the biggest revenue point in a game when it goes to the referral. Because what happens is, again, there is everybody's focused on the TV at that point in time. Everybody stops what they're doing. They run back in the living room because they've heard a wicket's going to fall. But the big one is at the actual venue, in front of a packed crowd, on the scoreboard, which is now a digital scoreboard. Yeah. They have advertising up there, and every single one of the 26,000, or if it's held here at the new Perth Stadium, 60,000 people turn their eyes to that scoreboard to look at what the outcome is. So the advertising revenue generated for that is more than for any other thing inside the stadium. And they said, you will never get rid of it now because it is such a big money earner.
Which strikes me as being bizarre that they would restrict the number of times that a team can refer things. If that's the case, I would imagine the broadcaster would be going, let them refer everything, every ball, referral.
Yeah, but I just find the cricket one just, I mean, as I say, when it's obvious, they still go, show me from this angle, show me from that angle. And you can see, you're sitting on your lounge and you go, the ball didn't carry. We saw it bounce.
The other side is, your appeal might be a genuine appeal. I mean, in the sense that you're not just appealing frivolously, as we've seen in previous years. You think you've got the guy out, and in real time, when you look at it, you go, geez, that's pretty close, that could be out. Then you get the slow-mo out and the stop cam, and you use all those other things to make a judgment on whether that person is out. But you penalise that person on the outcome of something that they could not have foreseen.
Yeah. And this is where I think we put is undue pressure on the umpires in both sports.
Yeah.
Because, again, hockey's so fast.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why I liked it when we actually, with Astra a few years ago at the Aslan Shah Cup, we had cameras on the umpires, on their heads. So you could see exactly what they could see and why they necessarily might have missed a decision. And it was really great. And you also saw the pressure players put on the umpire when something happened and they all came running towards them. And it gave you a real feeling of how intimidated they are and how strong they have to be to stand up to that. So in that respect, I have total respect for the umpires. I feel sorry for them in that. But just going back to your cricket one again, and you know this is a debate for another day. I do not like referrals on LBW. I do not believe that they can genuinely tell you
That's
how high the ball is going to pitch or what the direction
is going
to
be. Or how it was going to move.
Now, I've worked commentating certain sports, and I won't say which one, with Hawkeye. And I sat with the guy who was working Hawkeye. I said, how can you work out the trajectory of the ball? He goes, we can't. He says, it's a guesstimate.
Yeah, that's it.
So therefore, to me, the minute it's a guesstimate with LBWs, shouldn't be there.
No, I agree. Absolutely, I think when they use that technology for LBW. I mean, the snicker, I think, is good for caught behinds and those.
Although, if you read the laws of cricket, it says that the umpire should see the ball deviate. There's nothing about sound.
Yeah, no, you've said that before.
And an umpire can be deaf and be an umpire.
Well, the hot spot's an interesting one. Because, I mean, sometimes that's picking up contact that no human would ever really, in all honesty, be able to 100% truly say that they were aware of. That's quite interesting. You know.
Hey, look, it's never going to be perfect.
No, and in some ways it's come the full circle, because umpires aren't perfect and they never have been perfect. We brought this technology in because umpires aren't perfect. The technology's perfect, not perfect. So we end up back at the same point where we've just got to trust the decision that's given to us anyway and just get on with it.
I think if you go back to, and it's the old chicken and the egg thing, exactly what you're talking about. If you look when cricket, the referral system came in, first of all in cricket, or the video referral thing, the umpires like Dickie Bird, David Constant, David Shepherd, all of those were being forced to use it because they weren't using it. They were backing their own decisions. But how often were they wrong? They weren't wrong because they had those hours and hours of umpiring, standing in the middle. They knew the game inside out. They were all ex-players, and they knew it, and they knew how it all worked. And that was the difference. And now what I don't like is we're now actually relying sometimes too much on the technology that you're not seeing umpires make decisions when they should make the decision and we should trust them.
Yeah, and... Yeah, the beauty of sport was having to suck it up sometimes. Yeah. You just have to suck it up, fight on, and keep going, and put all that out of your mind. And the best and the strongest players can do that. The ones that can't end up, you know, falling by the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, I've been given out in the past when I never touched a ball.
Oh, yeah.
And I got wickets when batsmen hadn't touched a ball.
I remember in a preliminary final, standing in the middle of the ground, no one within cooey of me, and the ball's been hit to me, trapped it cleanly, and I turn up, I look up ahead in the field, and I think, right, I've got three blokes here, we're in, we could score here, and the umpire blows it for feet. Now, what the hell he was thinking, I have no idea, but you just got to suck it up. You know, it's as disappointing as it may be.
Well, we hope you enjoy debating these issues at home or wherever you're listening. But anyway, we'll be back with another podcast soon.
See ya. We'll be back next week.